This year, Congress passed tougher regulations for the credit card industry, hoping to provide relief for consumers. Some of the law's minor provisions took place back in the summer, but cardholders should brace for more pressure before the primary protections kick in. Some credit card companies are raising rates and reducing credit limits before the rules take effect on February 22nd. Democratic Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts is the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. He was one of the lawmakers who pushed for the new regulations, and he joins us now to talk about this new development. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
Does this fall into the category of unintended consequences?
Not at all.
Did you anticipate this might happen?
We were afraid it might happen, but there are two things. First of all, the only way for it not to happen was to not pass the law. You cannot allow private entities to blackmail you into never passing the law. Secondly, an unintended consequence is something that happened because of what you did. They are not exercising any powers that they did not already have. They could have done all this and presumably would have, whether we passed the bill or not. Now, we did have a political compromise. I wanted the bill to go into effect more quickly. The Federal Reserve said, oh, well, they need time. And others said they needed time. I was skeptical, but we don't always get all the votes we want on every issue.
Congressman, you said that some of the banks have abused this period that they were supposed to use to retool their practices. How have they abused the system?
By raising the rates. We told them that we wanted to put this into effect and that we thought these things were fair. We ought to stress, by the way, what's the single unfairest thing that we went after. This situation whereby you get a credit card, you are told what the rate is, you go out and you make purchases, and you owe money according to the contract you signed, and even though you've made every payment you were supposed to make, retroactively they raise the interest rates on what they already charged you. And we thought that was outrageous, and we did believe that they would not keep doing that. And I think to continue to raise the rates retroactively, that's very abusive to consumers. That's what we are putting an end to.
Now, we should say the credit card companies say these hikes and these rate cuts are not in any way a rush to beat the new regulations. They say that this is really a way that they need to cover the costs of all the losses that they've been hit with because of the recession.
Oh, no.
Is there truth to that?
They aren't doing these things because we passed the bill. On the other hand, once we passed the bill, they should have abided by it. And they said, look, give us more time because we have to redo our algorithms, et cetera.
But you're saying, it sounds like they're saying, give us more time so we can make as much money as we can before the new regs come into effect.
Now, give us more time so we can not abide by the law. We said you should abide by this law. They said, okay, but we agree we have to abide by the law, but it's going to take us time to figure these things out. And I think they lied about that.
We're heading into the holiday shopping season, a time when people might be more likely to reach into their wallets and pull out those credit cards. What should people who use credit cards be doing right now when their statements come in the mail?
First of all, shop around for different credit cards. People have not done that. And we think that some credit card companies will be willing to do that. Secondly, if they can, either pay cash or, and this is the way to do it, pay off your credit card bill before the time expires. You know, the credit card companies hate that. They don't like people who pay off the whole bill every month.
Congressman Frank, always good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
That was Democrat Barney Frank, chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. We asked the American Banking Association for its response to his claim that credit card companies lied about the need for more time to adjust to the new regulations. The association sent us this statement. As of August 20th, card issuers must provide a 45-day advance notice of any rate increase and give customers the option to decline the increase and pay off the balance over time at the original rate. Rates are going up for new accounts and new transactions in part because of the economy and in part because of the new rules, which Congress understood would cause rates to increase and credit card credit to be less available.
The writer Barbara Kingsolver has a story to share. She imagines a young man born to a Mexican mother and an American father. He spends a lifetime straddling two cultures and working out his own identity. He's the main character of Kingsolver's novel, The Lacuna. It explores issues that she's wrestled with again and again, in her fiction and in her life. Not long ago, Kingsolver herself moved from one very different part of America to another. After more than 20 years in the Arizona desert, she returned to her roots in Appalachia. NPR's Lynn Neary paid her a visit.
Barbara Kingsolver may have spent half her life living near the arid desert, but it's the dense, green, and on this day, very wet woods of the Appalachians where she feels most at home.
Is this the Appalachian Trail?
We're near the Appalachian Trail.
We're just in the middle of the Southern Appalachian eco region. That's kind of the heart of the place I want to be.
Kingsolver and her husband Stephen Hopp live in a renovated farmhouse in Southern Virginia, not too far from this trail. Hopp teaches at a local college, which is where they met. And for many years, they spent most of the year in Tucson and summers on the farm. Finally, they decided that this is where they belong, and so moved back to Virginia for good.
What's this creek or river running?
This is the Holston River.
No, this is this is Laurel.
Laurel. Oh, I'm sorry, you're right.
Yeah, this is Laurel Creek.
Laurel Creek.
This would be river status in Arizona, but it's a creek here.
That's true. Did it take some time to getting? I mean, this is such a different landscape from Arizona.
Well, it really is, and we had a very split. Well, I'll speak for myself. I had a very split psyche when I lived between the two places. When we came back here in the summers, I kind of let my breath out seeing all this water. It feels very safe to me to be surrounded by green growing things and water.
Kingsolver grew up in Kentucky, just a few hours from here, and she has family nearby, so she relishes that sense of being home. But she's also glad she got away. Those years in the Southwest changed the way Kingsolver sees the world.
I think the most interesting parts of human experience might be the sparks that come from that sort of chipping flint of cultures rubbing against one another. And living on the border between Mexico and the U.S. for so many years gave me a lot of insight into that.
Driven indoors by the rain, we retreat to the farm Kingsolver now calls home. A flock of guinea hens greets us as we arrive, and we are met at the front door by the family dog.
Thank you, sweetheart.
Thank you for watching the house.
This is where Kingsolver lives and writes, and she guards her privacy fiercely. It's only because of the bad weather that she reluctantly shares this private space with a stranger. Still, Kingsolver is a warm host, eager to make her guest feel comfortable.
Here, have a seat. I'll make us some tea.
Seated with a cup of tea in her book-filled study, Kingsolver talks about her new novel, The Lacuna. She remembers the day she thought of that title.
I came downstairs with great enthusiasm at the end of my writing day and announced to my family, I have a new title for this book, The Lacuna. And I got these kind of blank stares, and my husband said, well, I don't think everybody knows that word. And I said, well, I'm really sorry, but that's the word.
In Kingsolver's book, a lacuna has several layers of meaning. It's a tunnel that leads from one place to another. It also refers to a missing manuscript that creates a gap in the story.
There's always a part of the story you haven't heard that would influence your judgment if you knew it all. And when it comes to people we don't know, that part of the story gets bigger and bigger. It also applies to history. There's always a part of your own nation's history that you haven't been told, that really has a powerful impact on what you see around you and how you yourself may behave and may believe.
The novel, which spans a period from the 1930s to the McCarthy era, mixes fiction and history to tell the story of Harrison Shepard. Half American and half Mexican, Shepard gets a job working for the Mexican artists Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera. He lives in their colorful household during the time they are providing shelter for the exiled Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky. Kingsolver says she wanted to explore the relationship between art and politics in two different cultures, and Harrison Shepard, caught between two worlds and searching for his own identity, becomes the perfect vehicle for that exploration.
He has a clear understanding that life would be much better for him if he were invisible. He's struggling to find a place where he belongs and really to belong in his own skin.
It also, though, does give you a way to eavesdrop on these great figures, too, to have that kind of a character at the center of the story.
Invisibility is a great gift. He gets to go a lot of places because he has really cultivated this capacity to be unnoticed in the world. And therefore, he gets to sit in on a lot of really important conversations. And as a reader, so do you.
The intersection of art and politics, the flinty nature of disparate cultures rubbing against each other, the desire for privacy and simplicity versus the fame that comes with writing bestsellers. These are the kinds of borders Barbara Kingsolver constantly crisscrosses in her life and tries to make sense of in her novels. Lynn Neary, NPR News.
Hey, you can read a review of The Lacuna and an excerpt at our website, which is just one of several in our new column, What We're Reading. We've created a new feature to highlight some of the books we've found most compelling. Just go to npr.org/books. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. The New Orleans Saints are now 8-0, undefeated at the midpoint of their season. They beat the Carolina Panthers yesterday. The final score was 30-20. The perfect start has given hope to a city that has often hosted a Super Bowl but never quite managed to get its team into one. Melanie Peoples listened in to what a football Sunday sounds like now in New Orleans.
Sunday morning in this devoutly Catholic city finds much of New Orleans in church.
Holy, holy, holy Lord, God of heart and mind.
At Our Lady Star of the Sea in the St. Rock neighborhood, Father Tony Ricard leads a full congregation decked out in black and gold, many of them in Saints jerseys, looking like they plan on dashing straight from the pews to the big game. Services are running a little long today, and Father Tony knows it.
We all know it's almost time for us to get out of here, even though we got like 3 hours and 27 minutes before we have to be somewhere. But all I can tell y'all is what a joy it is to be in a church as a church family that's undivided and have a team with the New Orleans Saints that's undefeated. We know what we're talking about now.
This kind of Saints fear can't be contained. It spills over into everything. And while the stained glass Saints looking down from above are glorious, there are praises to be sung in another kind of cathedral just a couple miles away. Outside the Superdome, amidst the strains of a brass band stopping traffic, the fervent faithful gather.
This year is different. I'm so excited, I can't hardly stand it.
Martha Elliott has been a Saints fan her whole life, but this year she's enraptured in pure ecclesiastical ecstasy.
Because it just got that feeling. It's the spirit. It's the spirit. It's there. This year's our year.
Let's just say there have been a lot of seasons when it wasn't their year.
Oh, yeah, I was a fan whenever they were 1-15 and 2-14 and stuff like that.
Kevin Delcombe is another lifelong fan, one who never donned a paper bag over his head in shame or referred to the team as the Aints.
I mean, I went through the rough years and you kind of like, man, golly, what are they going to do? And now you finally see that they're doing good and then everybody gets behind them and I think the whole state's behind them.
It's not the first time. 3 years ago, the Saints made it to the playoffs when New Orleans really needed a lift.
It's like Hurricane Katrina. Everybody got together and they got behind the Saints, and same thing now.
With only one difference. Last time, everyone was united in tragedy. This time, with the city's population around 78% of what it was before Katrina, and people no longer asking whether or not New Orleans would come back, everyone's united in pure fun. That's a real milestone, and it feels good to people like Dennis Halligan.
Black and gold, everywhere you go, everyone, it's just like a big family now. It's just all come together, and on Sundays, it's like Thanksgiving, big turkey dinner. I mean, just everybody comes together. It's a blast.
And the national attention isn't bad either. New Orleans is in the news again, and for a change of pace, for something other than that dreadful hurricane. That makes the city feel pretty good, almost normal. It's the kind of happiness that spills all the way into Monday morning and beyond. For NPR News, I'm Melanie Peoples in New Orleans.
An elite boarding school in Massachusetts has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars renovating its library. Cushing Academy wasn't just redoing the walls and carpets or modernizing the stacks. It was getting rid of the actual physical books. The school's library has gone digital. And that has some librarians and book lovers worried, as Tina Antolini reports from member station WFCR.
If you happened into the Cushing Academy library a year ago, you would have found the pretty typical hushed atmosphere and tall stacks of books. But that's not the case anymore.
Here I'm in the middle of the library, and this is what it sounds like.
I love it here.
There's a new cafe where the circulation desk used to be, where there once were bookshelves. Students now sit in easy chairs, studying or watching three new flat-screen TVs. It's all part of what really have been two substantial changes at Cushing's library. The first is getting rid of the stacks, most of them anyway. And the second is to transform this place into a hub of activity to give what's now a largely virtual library a physical home and gathering space. Sophomore Elsie Eastman says she's here all the time now.
I remember last year I barely went to the library. Like, I loved the library. I just never really went.
Dean of Academics Susie Carlisle says school officials had noticed that. She says surveys they conducted showed students weren't turning to printed materials for research. They were immediately going online.
And part of our desire to move in this direction is to meet the students where they are most comfortable. And it's our responsibility as well to help students understand the emerging technologies that they are going to be faced with.
Carlisle says the library is trading its 20,000-volume collection for a database of millions of digital books. All students can access those books, either through the 68 Amazon Kindles cycling around campus or on the laptop that each student is provided. Headmaster James Tracy says Cushing's change has already upped their circulation numbers, and he says it's giving students access to the content of books that matters, not the format.
If I look outside my window and I see a student reading Chaucer under a tree, it is utterly immaterial to me whether they are doing so by way of a Kindle or by way of a paperback.
The library's scrapping of printed books brought a surge of online indignation when it was announced last summer. Tracy says that's no surprise. He shares a love of books and what he calls a nostalgic attachment to flipping the pages. But some bibliophiles say it's not just nostalgia. Camilla Alire is president of the American Library Association. While she's all for libraries riding the wave of technological changes, she says the issue here is how far Cushing went.
In terms of making that particular school library an either-or, students learn differently. And some students will take to digital resources and information technology like a duck takes to water. And then there are other students who learn by turning the pages, by handling the materials.
Plus, Alire says most schools couldn't afford Cushing's move. Tom Corbett, the executive director of Cushing's library, doesn't dispute that, though he says the price is coming down every day. In fact, he says resources are why Cushing decided to go whole hog for digital.
In order for librarians to really do a good job, an exceptional job of focusing on online resources, they really need to move away from some of the other priorities they've had in the past. And managing a large print collection is a lot of work.
But how the library manages its new digital collection is still largely a work in progress, as is how the students receive it. Five lit students clustered around a library table with their digital readers before them were a little ambivalent. They like their Kindles, but they don't love them. They say annotating is slow and annoying. And sophomores Cameron Akers and Thomas Pacheco are not totally convinced this change is the way the school should be going.
Without the books, kind of lose the feel of the library. It's a great study place, but I don't feel like I can read here anymore.
And also, like, it's not really quiet anymore like a usual library is anyway.
Yeah, a lot more distractions.
Whether their school is the vanguard of the 21st century or not, Some Cushing Academy students are still eager for the shush of a librarian and the immersion in a good old-fashioned book. For NPR News, I'm Tina Antolini in Western Massachusetts.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Paying for abortion has become a flashpoint in the healthcare debate. This weekend, the House approved its massive healthcare bill, but only after intense wrangling and the addition of an amendment that would limit insurance coverage of abortion. The move sparked a torrent of press releases and opining from both sides of the abortion issue, making it more difficult to figure out what the amendment would actually do. For that, we turn to NPR's Andrea Seabrook.
It's called the Stupak Amendment, named for the anti-abortion Democrat who fought for it, Michigan's Bart Stupak. He says it maintains a basic principle that's been in U.S. law since 1976, the Hyde Amendment. That bars federal health insurance programs like Medicaid from paying for abortion services. Stupak explained it this way.
Our amendment does one very simple thing. It applies the Hyde Amendment, which bars federal funding for abortion except in the case of rape, incest, or life of the mother, to the health care reform bill.
Abortion rights supporters say
nothing could be further from the truth.
Colorado's Diana DeGette.
If enacted, this amendment will be the greatest restriction of a woman's right to choose in our careers.
DeGette and other pro-abortion rights Democrats say this actually goes beyond the Hyde Amendment and would have much broader consequences for abortion services all around. Still, the Stupak Amendment won the votes of 39 Democrats, in part because of a strong lobbying effort from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. So to get a clearer picture of what this thing would do, it helps to actually take it out of context for once. Forget Hyde, ignore what this means in the decades-old tug of war about abortion, and just look at the Stupak Amendment. Here's what it says, translated to plain English. In general, government money cannot be used to pay for abortion. The government-administered health plan, often called the public option, will not cover abortion unless a doctor certifies that a woman is in danger of death without one, or the pregnancy is the result of rape or incest. If you get your health insurance through the government or with help from the government in the form of a tax subsidy, your plan will not cover abortion. In this case, you would have the right to buy extra coverage with your own money if you choose to. Now, if you get your health insurance through your state, as in Medicaid, your state could buy supplemental abortion coverage for everyone it insures. And 17 states already do this under Medicaid. The next section of the abortion amendment deals with the exchange. That's the government-administered service where people can buy insurance and join a risk pool. Remember, one of the reasons healthcare is so expensive for people who don't get it through their work is that they're not in a large risk pool. So the bill tries to group them together and cut costs for everyone. Private insurance companies that offer a health plan through the exchange are allowed to cover abortion, but if they're going to, the companies must also offer another plan that is identical in every way, except that it does not cover abortion. So, say you're buying insurance with your own money and you get it through the exchange. You can choose a policy that covers abortion or one that doesn't. But if you're getting help from the government to buy that insurance in the form of a tax subsidy, you may not choose a plan that covers abortion. You're still allowed to buy a supplemental policy with your own money. And that's it. That's what the Stupak Amendment says. It does not apply to private insurance bought with private money. What everyone's fighting about now is how this might play out in a whole new medical system and what it means in the broader narrative of abortion in America. All eyes are now in the Senate to see how it deals with abortion in its version of the health care bill. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, the Capitol.
Chesapeake Bay is the nation's largest estuary, and it's in poor health. That's despite decades of promises to clean it up. Today, the federal government announced the outlines of a new effort to help restore the bay. NPR's Richard Harris explains.
The bay is in trouble largely because it's being overwhelmed with nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediments from agricultural runoff, as well as from the 17 million people who live in the bay's watershed. One of the biggest victims of this has been the bay's once-thriving oysters. In a telephone news conference, Peyton Robertson from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said restoring the oysters is key to the new bay recovery effort.
We want to coordinate with Maryland, Virginia, and the Potomac River Fisheries Commission to recover historical oyster bars and establish self-sustaining oyster reef sanctuaries in 20 key tributaries throughout the bay by the year 2020.
Ultimately, the states and federal government will need to figure out how to reduce runoff into the bay. That means paying more attention to farms, which are the single biggest sources of nutrient-laden water. But better farm practices alone won't do the job. In fact, Environmental Protection Agency official Chuck Fox says agricultural runoff has actually been improving somewhat.
This is contrary to urban and suburban runoff loads, which in fact are increasing in the Chesapeake Bay watershed.
So an effective strategy means getting states and local governments to pay more attention to new or rebuilt subdivisions and other development. Up until now, most of the bay's restoration plans have been largely voluntary, loosely coordinated by Maryland, Virginia, Delaware, Pennsylvania, New York, West Virginia, and the city of Washington, D.C., which are all in the bay's watershed. The new plan, ordered up this spring by President Obama, will give the federal government a much bigger role. Some in the region have worried this could amount to a federal takeover of the effort.
I would respectfully disagree with that characterization completely.
Again, Chuck Fox from the EPA.
It is our view that this is a new era of federal leadership, but it is also our view that we have to do this in close partnership with state and local governments as well as those in the private sector.
States are expected to come up with new regulations and measures to heal the bay, but if those fall short, the federal government will step in with new rules of its own. The plan is still in draft form. It is a big step up from the volunteer efforts of the past two decades. And Bill Dennison at the University of Maryland's Center for Environmental Science says it's a welcome one.
This is exciting times for Chesapeake Bay. It's kind of a supersized restoration program. And I think it represents an opportunity to take the best studied bay in the world into the best managed bay in the world.
One feature of the plan is that the states and federal government will review their progress every 2 years and not simply wait as the restoration deadline of 2025 draws near.
We have defined goals and measurable progress in realistic time frames. We're not talking about what we're going to do in 5 or 10 years outside the political life cycle of any particular politician, but we're talking about what we can do in a couple years.
Now, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation has been the region's leading advocate for restoring the bay. Roy Hoagland at the foundation says the newly unveiled plan lays out neatly all the things that need to be done, but he's not entirely happy.
What was disappointing about this federal strategy is the lack of specificity. For example, it talks about developing new regulations for better managing urban and suburban stormwater. It doesn't have any details of what that better management might or might not be.
Those all-important details still need to be worked out. Richard Harris, NPR News.